So yesterday we had this event at the Wellness Collective called Creativity and Madness. It was a book launch for two books that just came out by each of the founders of the Icarus Project, which is a radical mental health support network. And Sasha Altman de Brule and Jax McNamara each put out their own publication, and they came and did readings from them. And then we just had a little bit of a discussion, and their books are now available as well as other community support and mental health, rad mental health publications are available now at the Wellness Collective. But yeah, it was awesome to hear their stories and how raw and real they are with their emotional landscape or their mental health. And yeah, and how all of that is great and okay. It was so cool.
So, hey.
Hi.
Thanks for coming. I'm Jax.
I'm Sasha. We've been friends for a long time. A little more than 10 years ago, we started this organization called the Icarus Project. That's this network of peer-based mental health support groups. And started off with a bunch of writing and ideas, and now there's all these people who've taken it and run with it.
So we started this thing called the Icarus Project. It's like an online community, a radical media project, all kinds of things, redefining how we think about mental health and creativity and madness and all kinds of good things. And then we both just wrote these books. My book is a book of poetry.
My book is a bunch of adventure travel stories.
And it's been super exciting, and we're going all around the country reading from them and inspiring people, and yeah.
A huge part of what we've been working on for years is trying to reframe the dominant narrative of what it means to be mentally healthy or mentally ill. And so part of the way that the way that I've been doing it is through writing stories about my life, and Jax has been writing poems. And so, yeah, we figured maybe we'll just read you some stuff, and you can tell us what you think.
Sounds good. Should I start?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. This first poem of mine is called Whether or Not You Fly. And so my book deals with lots of things, and one of them is sort of healing from trauma and figuring out what it means to be well in a crazy world that is self-destructing all around us and filling us with terrible ideas about ourselves and nasty inner critics. And for me, one of the big pieces of becoming more healthy has just been learning, it's a cliche, but it's really true, learning how to love myself and be kind to myself and give myself the things that I didn't have when I was a kid. And so that's some of what this poem's about. Whether or not you fly. When I grow up, I want to be Brandy Carlisle. I want to sing to tear the roofs off houses and serve you up your own heart on a plate. When I grow up, I just want to feel at home in this boy-girl body, at home on 10,000-foot mountains, at home in my own bed. I want to navigate rush hour traffic with calm and regular breath, get along with my family, make love with my eyes wide open, and call down the rain when I come. When I grow up, I want to jump off every waterfall without ever having to flinch. I love you even if you can't jump. Even if you stand at the top of the cliff shaking, wishing for your mom, even though she was so cruel. I love you in those moments when you can't speak, move, sing, jerk off, or smile. Those moments when you need to be small again. Small and held, not small and brave. I love you in those moments when you compare your hair to every other girl, your muscles to every other boy, when you look around the room and you find yourself deficient, because that's what you were trained to find. I love you with sand in your underwear after a wave knocks you out. I love you trying to pee when no one is looking. I love you unwitnessed, hungry, lonely, and done. I witness you. I witness you talking to that beat up 11-year-old girl inside your own chest, the one who cannot believe someone is finally listening to her. I witness you bring her daisy chains and ice cream and glitter. I witness you describing the perfect getaway that never happened. The one where all your friends show up in a blue car like Harry Potter and fly through the sky to somewhere safe. Safe. Later, I witness you hiking alone, 12 miles up and down bridges in the rain and the sun, anchoring your heels into the earth and your lungs into the sky, becoming part of the widest expanse of ocean that you have ever seen. I witnessed you hitching the last ride down the mountain to the last plate of fried chicken in the last town at the edge of the colonized world. I watch you wake up the next day, pray to the sunrise, press flowers in a book for your girl back home. I witness you wanting a family so bad you could taste it. I witness you hoping that this girl is the one. Hoping one day you get to plant the blueberry bushes you're both keeping in pots out back so they can root in the ground together. I witness you calculating budgets, debating careers, trying to paint, love, fuck, and make poems despite all the anxiety of hustling a life under capitalism. You are doing such a good job. You're making it, you adult, you dreamer, you kid. I see you when you leap into the sky, shrieking, only to find when you land that the water is deep enough to hold you.
So I wrote this book. It's called Maps to the Other Side, The Adventures of a Bipolar Cartographer. And actually, this piece that I'm going to read you, I wrote it a couple miles from here. I remember how it felt to write, how it felt to actually get down on paper and then be able to share. A huge part of my, as much as writing is hard for me, a huge part of my healing process has to do with being able to share the stuff in my head so I don't, you know, a huge part of ways I think a lot of people feel crazy is that they have a whole bunch of stuff in their head and then they don't share it, you know, and so the ability to be able to hang out with a bunch of strangers and share the thoughts in my head is really good. So yeah, I wrote this a few miles from here. It's called Dangerous Gifts. Writing for me has always been a pretty desperate attempt at fighting off loneliness. It's never been something that flows easily out of me. My writing's always been a bit of a dangerous gift, something that allows me to communicate with the outside world while simultaneously threatening to keep me shackled to the computer screen, all alone and feeling like a desperate animal. When I was a kid, I watched a lot of television and I read a lot of comic books. My favorite comic book was the X-Men. It was about a group of mutant teenagers being trained by their mentor, Professor X, to use their superpowers to fight off the forces of evil. I always wished I had superpowers. When I got older, I started reading about shamans and medicine people in indigenous cultures. People born sensitive that had endured transformative, traumatic events that gave them special abilities. In these stories, there was always mentors and guides to train them and set them on their paths as warriors and healers, just like in the comic books. Years later, I started realizing that all the most amazing people in my life, the wildest ones, the ones walking the edges and pushing the social boundaries, the ones making all the connections most normal folks were too afraid to make, all of them were people who had never really fit in when they were young. They'd been through their share of rough times and had somehow figured out their own ways of blazing through the world. All the people I knew who had been considered mentally ill and mad were like the mutants in the comic books, the misfits who had had to carve their own paths or else be eaten by the world around them. The mutant teenagers were me and my friends, but most of us never had mentors and guides to lead us through to the other side and teach us how to be superheroes. We just had each other. Those who are born mutants have it rough. The modern world wasn't made for the likes of us. Modern institutions and industrial standardization feel cold and heartless because our spirits are wild. We see the end of the world in flashing billboards and clear-cut forests. We feel the pain of others like it's our own. We can't hold regular jobs or make regular friends. We're told we're sick and we need to be medicated for our entire lives or else horrible things will happen. There's no place for us except in institutions or out on the street. We're outcasts and we gravitate towards other outcasts like us. People like us need community more. If we don't find strong communities, we'll spend our lives feeling out of place with a gnawing sensation that something's missing. If we're lucky, we find others like ourselves and we manage to build our lives on the fringes of the mainstream. But even in our rebel communities, we don't know how to take care of each other. No one taught us to get along with one another. There's so much hidden knowledge that would make it life easier, but we have no way to access it. But that's where our dangerous gifts come in. One important lesson I learned over and over is that the people who can help me when I'm struggling with my madness are the ones who've had the same problems and made it through themselves. Being damaged and traumatized can be a powerful gift if you figure out how to use it to help others come to terms with their own powers. I got locked up when I was a teenager because I didn't understand that I was different than most of the kids around me, that I had to take extra special care of myself to cultivate my powers and stay out of trouble. I wish someone had been there to offer guidance, someone who had been through it before and understood what I was going through. Our culture's version of guidance is to diagnose people as mentally ill, stick them on antipsychotic meds, and lock them up in a hospital. There's so many kids being locked up and given drugs because they don't fit the narrow roles that the system lays out for them. And there's only so much time before the way our culture thinks about mental illness. And there's only so much time before the way that our culture thinks about mental illness is dramatically discredited and melts into something new. What's it going to look like when it happens? I read stories from indigenous cultures and I imagine a different way. Shamans stay shamans by shamanizing, healing people with their powers, their dangerous gifts. They have to pass on the knowledge. That's what keeps them healthy. And that's why I do the work that I do. It keeps me healthy. If I want to survive, I don't have another choice. I have to figure out how to help other people who've been through what I've been through. I have to help weave with words and ideas the safety net to catch people who fly too high, because it's going to be the same net that's going to catch me when I fall.
That's great. So I'm going to do a piece that's called So Many Ways to Be Beautiful. And it's about a different kind of mutant superpowers. Part of my story has been, I'm queer, and I identify as third gender or genderqueer, and part of becoming healthy for me has been being able to just live in who I am and write about it and talk about it and find other people like me. And that's part of what this piece is about, although it's also kind of about everything else in the entire world. It's called So Many Ways to Be Beautiful. This is a story about when your mom died and a boy loved you and a boy left you and a girl loved you and you left her and your dad left too. This is a story about the neighborhood with singed wings and pride like a barbecue smoking out back. This is a story about not giving up over and over again. This is a story about believing that you have a broken heart, not a mental illness. This is a story about the ache you come home to every night and learn to hold in your arms like the child you once were, even though no one held you in their arms back then. This is a story about becoming capable of leaving enough space between words that someone else can read your story too. This is a story about learning to cook squash, cut hair, connect pipes, drive stick, mix flesh tones, lay down loops, fix your brakes, grow garlic, get consent, and take no prisoners. This is a story about bleeding a poem, wearing a cock, making a skirt, hiding your shame, knotting a tie, and using the heel of your boots to bring her home. This is a story about the end times and the way they become the beginning if you survive. The empty hours, the end of June, pull your mother's ring off the shelf where it slept with a lock of her hair since the moon went black, and light a candle, know you were loved. Pull a song from your throat and a stone from his lungs and remember that you are stronger than all the nightmares, ghosts, and police. This is the shape of almost but not quite home. Okay, a perfect, horrible city where brown boys get shot by white cops, where white girls cry while helicopters fly over and over the backyard, where babies are still learning to walk, but the fog always cancels July. Shape of sound, shape of sky, shape of too many names for nowhere and nowhere left to hide, city of potholes, city of angels, city of passion flowers, salt and song, what if? What if we finish what we started? What if we brought the pigs down? What if we wrote the books that no one else is writing about the lives we are still living, the bodies we are still loving, the signals we are crossing, the men at the border, the women on the street, the people with mismatched pronouns and pair, the people with bound breasts, pink heels, striped pants, gender dysphoria, and so many ways to be beautiful that only the school children can find the names. What if we brought our gospel home? I'm gonna do a piece. It deals with being suicidal in a different way. It's the title poem for my book. It's called In Between Land. And it's about journeying back to wanting to be on this planet after not wanting to be on this planet. And trigger warning, there's a little mention of incest. It's not graphic, but it's in there. So if that's gonna be hard for you to hear right now, feel free to like step outside or do what you need to do. All right, In Between Land. I wish someone had told me I would get out of the burning house, or that I had already escaped it a long time ago and it lived on only in my muscles and my mind. I wish someone had handed me the word survivor, placed it in my palms like a blossom or a drill, told me to build altars and hang hinges carefully. I wish they had told me I could stand up any time, open the door and leave. It's 1986. I'm lying on my back in a hot room. My father blocks the door and tells me fairy tales with cruel endings, Goldilocks shut in a closet and forced to eat beetles by her parents after she gets lost in the woods. He leans over to kiss me on the lips where I don't want to be kissed. He wishes me goodnight again. It's 2006. I am lying on my back in a room with red velvet curtains, walls covered in fairies and pelts. I'm lying on the table of a psychic named Sue whose hands know things I just can't explain. She touches my shoulders and she asks where I am. In space. Asteroids, comets, a large silence of almost nothing. That far away? That's why I can't find you. My eyes are closed and I can't tell if I'm sinking or floating. You haven't chosen to stay on this earth yet, have you? No, 26 years and counting. I wish someone had told us that the years spent journeying back and forth across In-Between Land would not be a waste, that the miles and the blizzards could not be avoided, that we would find the necessary roads, the necessary words, the mystery between them both. I wish that they had told us about earthquakes, that we were not crazy, that sometimes the unspeakable erupts out of the fault lines in your spine. The body will stop shaking, the ground stops buckling despite aftershocks, despite fire. Eventually, something settles. Water turns clear, birds come back in the morning. You choose earth, you make breakfast, and you go on. My best friend and I used to talk about choosing earth and sky. We traveled between borders, leading workshops for survivors who had known, rocks that whisper billboards who shout conspiracies and cosmic truths, electric hearts impaled on apocalypse sunsets over ruined cities and paper mountains, speaking myths that evaporate like water off hot pavement when you finally come down. Down into the world of toothpaste and toilet paper, fathers and sons, appointments, diagnoses, mania, psychosis. But we knew we were caught trying to fly out of the mazes built by kings and corporations, where your wings melt once you finally make it over the sea. When we would mention keeping one foot in both worlds, everyone in the room would exhale. Eyes like fireflies switching on at dusk. Permission. This too is real. In between land. Both. You don't have to choose between your sanity and the roofless night. It's It's 2012, and I'm lying on the floor of a small room, while a therapist in a black muscle tee emblazoned with hope in white letters draws infinity symbols above my eyes. I follow her fingers, and I freeze, as usual, until the images come. The shadow shapes of men, my father leaning over, thick stories, heat, suddenly the impulse to roll onto my side, stand up, open the door, and leave. For the first time ever, I do. Outside, the world is big as snow, bright as a waxing moon, my full of people. My hands are full of tools, my eyes are full of horizon. I am enormous, a child finally landing in an adult's miraculous skin.
So for 8 years of my life, I had this column in this magazine that was mostly read by alienated kids in the suburbs. It was like this punk rock magazine. And so I got to write whatever I wanted for them. And it started off as a gardening column, and then it was a gardening column. I wrote about, you know, the farms I worked on and stuff. And then I started writing about mental health. And here's a short one that I wrote just up the road. Sometimes when I close my eyes, I can see it, like intersecting tree branches in the forest, or outlines to the chlorophyll on a mature maple leaf when you hold it up to the sun. It's the safety net my friends and I are weaving to take care of each other in this crazy world. And it's as real and strong as the energy, passion, and hard-earned skills we put into it. Sometimes I feel it viscerally, like when we're working out in the fields or eating a meal that we've all prepared. Sometimes I feel it all alone or surrounded by strangers in unfamiliar territory. The knowledge that my people are out there and have my back when times get hard. Our net is physical. Our house, our barn, our tools, our cars, the fields and the woods. But the net extends beyond our farm with the trust and friendship between people, our crew, our loved ones, and the loved ones of their loved ones, spreading like branches in a network that reaches across the world. The safety net is a force we create, woven in spirit. I used to travel all over the country, meeting new people wherever I went. Part of me always figured that if I made enough friends, I'd never get into too much trouble, because I'd have folks to look after me through the rough times. A big anarchist family of freaks and rebels. But too many times, I learned that things just don't work like that. Hundreds of phone numbers and email addresses in your slingshot organizer or faces on your Facebook account will still leave you alone and helpless if you ever really need a friend to be there for you. There are lessons on the road, but not so many about stability and continuity. And the internet is great for a lot of things, but there's no substitute for another person running their hands through your hair and rubbing your shoulders and holding you when you need to be held. It's taken me a while to figure out that the way to make friends I can trust to have my back is by working together on intense projects and sticking around to see things through the hard times. But building the kind of safety nets I'm talking about takes more than just working together on projects. It's about finding language to talk about internal worlds, learning each other's stories and histories, talking honestly about our issues and our triggers and what we've learned to do about them. Do we stand guard over each other and know what's in each other's best interest when times are rough? Do we know each other's warning signs and know what to do when they appear? Do we make sure that the people in our community are taking care of the basics, getting enough sleep, eating enough good, healthy food, exercising every day, keeping a routine that works for them, doing things that they love and feel passionate about? Do we know how to talk about past traumas in a way that feels safe? Do we create regular spaces and times to talk about the hard stuff? Do we respect the people in our communities who've made it through hard times and have lessons to share? There's so much to learn from each other. What does it take to feel comfortable asking for help if you need it? And when you ask, do we know how to respond? What issues can we deal with ourselves? And when does it make sense to explore healing modalities, from herbalism to acupuncture to homeopathy to Western psych drugs, if that's what it takes? Can we respect the different personal decisions we make to take care of ourselves? I've been crossing paths with folks taking an active role in organizing, inspiring mental health support in their communities, weaving safety nets out of hard-earned lessons and singed wings. I quietly watched dozens of people on the Icarus Project website talking about forming mutual aid support groups in their local communities. In New York City, there's a thriving little scene of people who come to meetings that mix support and community organizing. We've started these mental health skill shares. Folks share personal coping strategies with open forums. We're organizing student support groups on college campuses. We have people doing support group organizing as far away as New Orleans, Louisiana, Portland, Oregon, and Northampton, Massachusetts. This is how we hold each other up through the long haul. This is how we weave our own safety nets together.
So I'm gonna do a piece. It's the last piece in my book. Yeah, I'll just read it. It's called Towards Fire. I'm gonna stand up. I feel weird sitting in this chair performing poetry. All right, Towards Fire, one. I remember when I painted grace as a place with no people. Grace is a doorway into the moon, or hills rolling out to horizon, desert, sea, a circle of perfect blue. Grace, the water that held me aloft under a sky with no skin, kind only in its emptiness, whispering vast. Two. I aspired to a slow heartbeat in all situations. Weightless bones, plenty of time. I did not wear a watch or ride in ambulances. I never burst into tears and argued with cops. Grace was a clean floor before dawn, sitting in lotus and facing a wall. No late nights, nothing smoking, just the murmur of chants in a foreign language I didn't even speak. Nine bows, three bells, grace, the space behind the clouds. Three. One May, I woke up red. I was sure that my soul had jumped outside my skin, stitched on like a shadow at the heels. I set fires, I flew 3,000 miles, I drank wine at lunch, sang ballads to weeds, and seduced other people's trouble. Eventually, I started wanting the messy things, a child requiring haircuts or a lover requiring meals, the other side of a hard fight. Four. It took many years of dislocation and weeping to shake the ribs, many nights of scratching scars and startling awake to remember how women leave and men violate, how women violate and men leave before I swallowed my soul back inside. It grew like a child and made me nauseous with truth. It got stuck in my windpipe. The soul screamed, and I fought to swallow the sound. Painkillers did not work. The struggle became louder. Finally, I looked for grace to encourage the soul's extension into my hands, its descent through my legs. Five. A canyon, a sister, a misfit monk to cradle my ankles, a medicine woman to press hard on my heart. Sandbags, needles, pens, queers, crips, and beloved crazies to listen to me and know. The experiments, lovers reaching inside and leaving, lovers holding me down, fists inside muscles shaking with what it might mean to stay. One day, a teacher to insist that I find the dignity in my spine, that I extend my quaking arms towards something like a future. Beside other people extending theirs. The soul filled out the abandoned spaces. The stories began burning down into my feet, making light. My steps began to hum. Grace became a verb. Six. I carried my questions then back to the sea and the patient desert. Still, they spoke of grace. Grace and storms, storms and justice, justice and the heartbeats of our people. Dreamers, healers, rebels, you must walk with your singing feet toward the blood of sunrise, next to others grown full from the same walking.
I'm going to read two pieces right next to each other. Here, I'll stand too. So these two pieces were written in between the pieces. I managed to get locked up in a psych hospital for a while. And so they reflect, like, the piece that I'm going to read you now was written shortly before I got locked up in the psych hospital. It's called My Faith in the Mad Ones. I've been obsessed with that Martin Luther King quote, "Human salvation lies in the hands of the creatively maladjusted." Human salvation lies in the hands of the creatively maladjusted. He actually said, he said it 6 different times in different speeches. There's something in those words that's like a shining light in the dark to me, reframing the conversation in this brilliant and visionary way. And it was MLK talking in the late 1960s. It's like that permaculture principle, the problem is the solution. It's staring straight at our fears, something about cultural evolution, about wounded healers, something that circumvents the whole combating stigma dialogue in the current mental health arena and puts us smack in center stage. I like the language of the mad ones. As in, I have faith in the power of the mad ones because they're the only ones crazy enough to think they can change the world and have the outlandish vision and drive to be able to do it. I've been thinking about what a large coalition of diverse groups uniting in an effective and long-term way might look like. I keep reading books about the 60s political movements, and they're simultaneously inspiring and miserably depressing because there was so much potential. We're trying to recreate that energy 40 years later, and it was crushed so hard that most of us don't even know our own history. I don't know about you all, but I want to be part of a movement that has the language to talk about power and class and race and gender without devolving into fragmenting identity politics. A movement that's full of love and actually prioritizes supporting the people in it. A movement that can collectively learn from its mistakes. A movement that knows its history and tells the stories publicly and loudly and beautifully. A movement that prioritizes community health and community support in ways that capture people's imaginations, in ways that the states and corporation would never be able to do. And a movement that has mad respect for wild dreams and true diversity, and the ones who, by their very nature, don't fit into neat boxes and never will under any system. A movement of the people that respects the freaks and the wild ones. I also like the language of the mad ones because of the double meaning of mad. It might alienate a mainstream movement, but goddamn, there's a lot to be mad about, and we better be talking about it with all of our love and rage. When it comes down to it, we can debate whether there are genetic components to what's now considered mental illness, but fundamentally, our message is that society is driving us mad. Oppression makes people crazy. Maybe some are more predisposed, but mad ones cuts across race, class, and gender lines in a way that has the potential to unite all kinds of different groups. All right, so that piece goes on for a little while, but I'm gonna skip ahead because I guess what I'll say is that it's interesting. Someone just interviewed Jax for Oprah magazine. There's a piece about Oprah magazine, and the frame of it is like talking about the Mad Pride movement. Like the work that we do gets, people are trying to put names on it, and so we, you know, and there was a point where I really liked the language of madness, and then that shifted. I'm gonna tell you about that. So once upon a time, I lived in a farm down the road from here, and then, you know, I managed to get my ass locked up in a hospital. And when I got out, I didn't know what to do with myself. You know, my friends loved me, but were like, dude, you're too crazy. We can't deal with you. And, you know, the organization that I had worked for was like, you need to take a break, man. Like, you need to do something else. And so I did this very uncharacteristic thing. I went and I lived in a yoga ashram for a year. And so that's the context. All right.
And he wore yellow a lot.
I wore white. I wore all white. Etymology of the word attention. To tend to watch over, to care for. At first, sitting down to meditate for 30 minutes was excruciating. My head was so filled with noise. Critical voices, self-defeating thoughts, old punk rock songs about nuclear war. psychic noise from the depths of my consciousness. Trying to be present with myself just made me feel crazier. The instructions they gave us were simple. The best way to keep the mind in the present moment is to focus on the breath. Attempt to stay with the sensations of each breath by counting each inhalation and exhalation. Try and make it to 10 and then start from the beginning. Bring your awareness to your heart chakra at the center of your chest. Keep bringing it back. When you realize you've gotten distracted, bring the awareness back to your breath and to your heart. I felt trapped in the room and wanted to run out. Eventually, though, I had brief moments of clarity. It was like a veil lifting. I began to witness my thoughts and emotions as they were arising. And rather than identifying with them, getting caught in them, I could see them disappear, like clouds. It was as if I was watching as a witness, and I felt wonderfully calm and focused. Then, periodically, one of the swamis or a guest speaker would say something that would hit me powerfully. I'd take the feeling into my meditation practice. I would have a sense of all of us as being sparks of the eternal flame, or drops in the divine ocean, or have a tangible feeling that the secret to peace was hidden inside the human heart. I had this one yoga instructor, this hilarious man, who would get us to breathe deeply into these deep, hard-to-hold yoga poses, and then tell us to find the joy in our physical sensations. He'd tell us that joy was a key ingredient of being present, and that if we could follow our joy, it could unlock the gates of our consciousness. There was something about that teaching that really worked for me. I could feel it tangibly in my body. That advice took my yoga and meditation practice to this whole other level. A few months later, I was teaching the yoga classes every day, and I was using my newfound connection to joy and presence to raise the awareness of the room. One day after teaching a class, I went for a walk on the beach. I had this realization that had been building for months. I was thinking about my life back home and my friends and the community of the Icarus Project, and I concluded I was done with the language of mad pride. Neither madness nor pride were things I was interested in cultivating. I wanted to be part of a mental health movement that could help raise the level of consciousness of the world and bring people together, not just fight on the ground with the same old identity games. Madness, by definition, was about not being in control. Spiritual discipline was working a lot better for me, and I had a hunch that the same would be true for many folks who were drawn to the Icarus Project. I longed to figure out how to bring the spiritual connection of the ashram together with the politics of my community back home. And if you want to know what happens next, you got to read my book. Here's a quick botany lesson. Remember, I'm writing for teenagers in the suburbs. Plants reproduce sexually through their flowers. They tried to teach me about this on a blackboard in a fluorescent lit classroom in the Bronx when I was a teenager, and I couldn't have been less interested. Years later, spending time around plants, I realized how magical they are. The male part of the flower is known as a stamen and produces pollen to fertilize the female part, known as the pistil. The pistil has an ovary that develops into the fruit and ovules, the egg cells, which develops into the new seeds for the next season. This wild sex orgy going on all around me as I write this is wrapped up in the story of the bees and other insects, because they're gathering pollen and nectar and cross-pollinating plants with each other. Some plants cross-pollinate through wind-blown pollen, but most of them need the insects to help them out. The flowers and the insects actually co-evolved with each other in the same way that humans co-evolved with food crops, weeds that we domesticated. I'll stop here to say that I just got this job teaching kids this summer at a summer camp not too far from here. It's like environmental science that I'm teaching, but I really don't have a background in environmental science, but I convinced them to hire me, and so it's going to be a trip. Anyway, one of us couldn't exist without the other, and in the end, a whole lot of us, from the bee gathering nectar in my squash patch to the royal idiot sitting in the White House, are intimately connected. And it's a little scary, but it gets more amazing. Flowering plants can be divided into three categories. Most plants have what are known as perfect flowers, meaning that they have both male and female sex parts in the same flower. Interesting language given trends in gender politics dialogues and the social construction of sexual identity. Peas, beans, and tomatoes have perfect flowers. They're all self-pollinated plants, meaning they don't need other plants to get their groove on with the universe. But the bees end up crossing a certain number of them anyway, just for fun and diversity. Then there are plants that are considered dioecious, which means they have separate male and female plants in a population. A good example of this is the humble marijuana plant. At a certain stage, any given population of pot plants grown from seed will segregate into male and females. Before the male plants have time to set pollen and fertilize the females, they're usually pulled out, which makes the females produce lots of resin on their buds in a vain attempt to capture any stray pollen which might float by. This keeps the plants from producing seeds that make their buds grow large and swollen. Spinach is another less racy example of a dioecious plant. The third type of flowering plants are monoecious, which means they have separate male and female flowers together on the same plant. The whole squash family is monoecious: cucumbers, zucchini, pumpkins, melons, and winter squash. If you get a chance to check out a flowering squash plant, you'll notice the big yellow flowers all look similar, except that the females have an ovary at their base that ends up becoming the squash fruit once it's pollinated by traveling insects carrying male pollen. Do yourself a favor and hang out by some flowers and check out the scene. They won't mind. Flowers are exhibitionist in nature. It's part of their evolutionary strategy. Look at all the little parts. Try and figure out which are male and female. Which kinds of insects land on them? Where do the seeds form? How do they disperse themselves? Even if it's just the dandelions and plantain and dock and mugwort growing out of the cracks in the cement next to your apartment building, it's happening there for you to experience. Once you realize the brilliant colors and sexy, alluring shapes of flowers are all about attraction and sex, and we wouldn't be here without them, suddenly the world feels a little less cold. To speed the process along, get some flower seeds, scatter them over your neighborhood, and wait for a little rain. Yeah, I've never read any of that stuff out loud. It was interesting. So,
there you go.
The arc of this book is that it starts when I'm 21 years old riding freight trains in Mexico, and then it ends, like, now. And in between then and now, you know, I've, like, learned a bunch of interesting lessons, and the getting locked up in psychiatric hospitals and having to put my life back together has actually been a huge part of those lessons and the way I figured them out. And I think we were on the way up here, we were checking out, and just yesterday they announced the NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, just made this decision that they're not going to support the DSM-5, which is the new version of the psychiatric Bible that's coming out. So there's all this internal politics going on around the idea of what is mental illness. And it's basically two enormous forces that are both really just fueled by money and a very skewed paradigm of what the world is like. But it's a very interesting time we're living in right now, because when stuff like that happens, it creates these little openings where the folks like us who have different ideas about how things should be have a little more chance to get in there and shape opinion. So, you know, this book is like the most non-scientific book you could possibly think of. It's, you know, me traveling around having adventures. But the whole point of it is to understand that, you know, all of us, we're walking around telling stories to ourselves all the time about ourselves. All of us. We have our own personal stories that we tell, and we retell them all the time when we're talking to other people. And then there's the stories that, you know, our friends come together, we tell each other stories. And then there's the larger dominant stories that are there. And we have a lot more power than we think in how we get to tell our own stories. And that's like the message, if there's anything I want you to remember about, you know, me sitting here reading stuff, is that you have the power to, especially if you get together with your friends, to shape your stories in ways that can be more empowering. So that's,
yeah, and I have one last poem I'm gonna do.
Cool.
That's a really good segue into my last poem. I kind of want to do my plant poem, which is really short. I'm going to do my really short plant poem.
Yeah.
And then my last poem. It's not as sexy as Sasha's plant poem. All right, it's called How to Identify Plants. You don't have to remember the names of people. Immerse yourself in pattern language, not faces. Imagine how they survive so many months without rain. I live in California. Their vertical leaves, white powders, fine hair, spikes, rinds, roots, 30 feet deep to tap groundwater, even though they're only 6 inches high. They are your friends and your ancestors. They can teach you what it means to stay and what it means to let the year change your blossoms into the brown rattling of seeds and fallen stars. They will rarely be unkind to you. They will never remember your name. They will offer you beauty and poison whether or not you behave. When you cannot find the words to tell anyone what galaxy you're hiding in, they will still be trustable, even radiant, under streetlights, without a moon. I'm a big plant person. They're a huge part of how I survive in the world. So the whole telling our own stories and reframing what we get to say about ourselves and the people around us has also been really important to me in my life and in the work that we've done with the Icarus Project, which we really started as a place to tell new stories, to create new culture and language for what we go through. One of the other places where I have really gotten to reframe some stories in my life is in my community. I'm part of a sort of queer arts community in the Bay Area in California, where people are exploring lots of things around gender nonconformity and just generally with the world order that we are handed by people. And this is a poem about that. It's called Lung Seed. It was her idea to ask about my gender, and it was my idea to lie to myself. For a long time, except it was not my idea at all. It is the world's idea that we should lie to ourselves, that we should not find names for experiences that do not fit in boxes. It's an idea that gets inside your own story until you think you made it up. To try to write this still stops my breath. My head threatens to detach like an agitated balloon lifting off a secret body. There is a terror to being broken, but there is a terror to never being known. She gave me my new name in November, when the days were filling with rain. It lived on one side of the bay, this name, for a long season of heavy soil and small rooms. In the spring, it began to bud out and scratch the inside of my throat. A lung seed becoming a tree, a language determined to grow. In June, I asked the world to use the name by emailing a fact to 93 people. It referenced flapjacks, famous hitchhikers, Wikipedia's take on third gender, and a dog named Jack from young adult science fiction who is as immune to psychotic outbreak syndrome as I one day hope to be. One day of euphoria and 30 days of shame, words burning visible across my chest, hunting through every gender book on Amazon for the things that made me spend the morning crying. Genderqueer is on the spectrum of trans, visualizing the ship of my body casting off from the harbor of woman into something so much more uncertain and so much more vast. Spending the nights reading the things that made me come hard, imagining a power between my legs that I had never let myself own. Too much to speak, almost enough to sing. Words became brittle, words took on a shine. Words hung suspended between notes like raindrops on cobwebs, like small bits of fabric caught in barbed wire fence. Everything is now open for investigation. Shoes, hats, hours, pronouns, years, sweating belly, hiding breast, too few names for nowhere and nowhere left to rest, a city with a lake for a heart, a summer with fog for breath, we place our bodies behind microphones, we place our bodies on the streets, our bodies become words cast off from land, navigating silver, legible at the edge of day, glitter and the dark unknown. We are the sounds of sex and bird calls, the shape of scars and clothing piled in corners, abandoned, redrawn. We are eyes opened in the morning to angel bones stacked up against the window, silhouettes of change outlined somewhere between war and the future.
Thanks.